From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 4 years ago when two candidates for governor put out a very different kind of ad. The Republican in the race in Utah was Spencer Cox. The Democrat was Chris Peterson. They had never met each other until the campaign, and yet there they were starring in a series of ads together, and the ads went viral. I want to listen to the audio of one of those ads from 4 years ago in Utah.
I'm Spencer Cox, your Republican candidate for Utah governor.
And I'm Chris Peterson, your Democratic candidate for governor.
We are currently in the final days of campaigning against each other.
But our common values transcend our political differences, and the strength of our nation rests on our ability to see that.
We are both equally dedicated to the American values of democracy, liberty, and justice for all people.
We just have different opinions on how to achieve those ideals.
But today, we are setting aside those differences to deliver a message that is critical for the health of our nation.
That whether you vote by mail or in person, we will fully support the results of the upcoming presidential election, regardless of the outcome.
Although we sit on different sides of the aisle, we are both committed to American civility and a peaceful transition of power.
And we hope Utah will be an example to the nation.
Because that is what our country is built on.
Please stand with us on behalf of our great state and nation.
My name's Spencer Cox.
And I'm Chris Peterson.
And we approve this message.
All right, Connections listeners, if you hadn't heard it before, you're probably not surprised to find out that that hits me right in my sweet spot. That is, boy, I can't believe there's not more of that. I love it. And in subsequent interviews, they went on talk shows together. Each candidate referred to each other as a great guy. They really seemed to mean it. And now a study finds that this kind of politics is one way to reduce political polarization and maybe even lower the risk of partisan violence. The study sampled more than 32,000 participants, testing 25 different interventions, including ads like that one. And the study found that 23 out of the 25 interventions had at least some positive effect. So what are these 23 ways to start bridging the political divide? This is a great day to start working on exactly that problem. And I want to thank our guests for being here this hour to take us through what we are learning there. Dr. James Druckmann is with us. Jamie is the lead researcher, one of the lead researchers on the study and a political scientist with the University of Rochester. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Cameron Hecht is with us. Cameron's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Rochester and had plenty to do with not only what was researched, but what we're going to talk about right here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so come on, let's get a little mushy, guys. I love that ad. I mean, that's so directed right at me. But not surprisingly to me that ad was very, very popular. It went viral for a reason, don't you think, Dr. Druckmann?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was obviously very unusual, especially during the 2020 election cycle, as it would be during this election cycle.
How'd that hit you, Dr. Hecht?
Yeah, I think it's powerful, and it actually speaks to one of the common types of themes that came up in the interventions that got tested in this competition, which is kind of highlighting common identities across political lines. So getting people to think more about what they have in common with people rather than focusing on their divided political parties.
We're going to learn, obviously, a great deal in the days to come, not just who's elected president or what the makeup of the Senate and Congress is, but we're going to learn a lot more about the makeup of our electorate. And one of the things that I'll be looking for when the data is out is how many Americans are living in landslide counties now. The data I have goes back to 1976. Jimmy Carter's elected, and only about 24% of Americans lived in landslide counties. That's defined as a county that has a 20-point or more margin in the presidential election. And what it really means is that probably if you live in a landslide county, you've got some neighbors who disagree, but you might not ever see them. You might not live on a street with anyone who disagrees. It might be all the same yard signs on your street or on your block or in your area or in your apartment building. And I don't think that's particularly healthy. Well, Donald Trump gets elected in 2016, and we were up to 60% of Americans in landslide counties. So 8 years later, I don't know where it is now. I presume it's even higher, probably 2/3 or more of Americans in landslide counties, and now more than 20% in super landslide counties, you know, a 40% margin in the presidential election. That worries me, because what I hear in that ad, Dr. Druckmann, is the reason I think people like that ad is people think about their neighbors and they mostly like them. They bake them cookies around the holidays and they rake leaves together and they might coach each other's kids. And they don't, even if they vote differently as they do on my street. They don't think of him as some sort of monster. And they want to think of politicians as capable of that. And yet the media ecosystem tells us, no, you know, the monsters, you have to have voting. So that kind of goes back to that neighborly narrative. And I think it's natural for people to want that. But can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I think it's a great point about the sorting that has gone on in terms of geography. And so what we've seen over the from 1976 to 2020 and today is that we've seen the parties become more geographic based. And then so the Republicans have become more of a party of the rural population and mm-hmm. Democrats of the urban population, which is fairly obvious. And then we've also seen kind of movement in those geographies. And so people aren't necessarily making choices to move to one place or another because of their partisanship, but it's factors related to their partisanship. And then what you end up with is this massive geographic isolation insofar as most people live in areas where most of their neighbors do share their partisanship. And so the interpersonal contact with knowing somebody from the other party, which is one of the most substantial ways to depolarize, that disappears. And so how do you learn about the other party then? Is you learn about it from media, right? If you can't learn about it firsthand, you learn about it from what you consume. And what you're consuming has become more and more partisan in the 21st century as well, right? Because if we go back to, you know, the end of the 20th century, that was just the beginning of partisan media. And even at that point in time, the audiences were still pretty mixed, but now they're completely separated. And so you end up with a scenario where you're not learning about the people who live next door to you from other parties. You're learning about people you're learning about the other party from media, which is programmed often with the intent of degrading that other party. And so you end up with perceptions that the other party is quite extreme, even though the reality is that most voters are much more moderate than what we see in the media.
Cameron, anything you want to add there?
I completely agree with what you said. The only thing I would add is the increasing role that I think social media has played in the perception of how polarized we are. I don't want to get the statistics wrong, but some vast majority of political content that is posted on social media is posted by the 10% most extreme people on both sides. And so I think this, in addition to people consuming different news media sources, continues to contribute to people seeing kind of the most extreme sides of the respective parties when they're looking at political content on social media.
So let's talk about what was studied. And really, I want to start with the generalization. One of the takeaways in just reading about it is that we don't have to be nihilistic, that there are interventions that can work here. And that wasn't a guarantee. That's why we study things. We want to see if different inputs produce results here. But Dr. Druckmann, what's your first takeaway when you see 23 out of 25 produce some kind of positive result here? Should that give me a little bit of hope that polarization can be diffused a bit?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it gives us some insight into exactly what is underlying why we see the extent of polarization that we do, because if we can understand what decreases it, then we understand what causes it. Like, it's just the flip side. And then it does give you some hope to how can we build on those to have more scalable interventions that could actually have an effect at a larger extent than this study, which was obviously an isolated one-time study. So I think it does give a little bit of hope.
And Dr. Hecht, what's your takeaway from the broad view of what was studied here?
Yeah, I agree. I was surprised to see how many interventions had a significant and positive effect on reducing people's feelings of partisan animosity. And honestly, also the size of the effects were kind of surprisingly large, too, larger than I would have expected from so many different approaches being tested from kind of different perspectives. And that's not to mention that there were promising effects found from several of the intervention on people's support for undemocratic practices and support for political violence, which luckily at base, those measures are kind of low. But we also saw people developing interventions that even reduce those things a little bit.
So we're not too far gone, essentially, right? I mean, truly. I don't mean to be flippant here, but there are times where it feels people start to talk very nihilistically about this. And it turns out we're not too far gone yet.
I think that's right. I think, again, we want to draw a distinction between kind of what citizens are thinking and what they're willing to do and kind of what elites are saying. And I think that's a pretty clear line that we have to draw, especially with the type of rhetoric that we've seen in the last several campaigns, in the last several presidential campaigns. And again, what we're kind of seeing amongst the elites in campaigns and even on media is you know, very extreme kind of dichotomous rhetoric about kind of your side or the other side. And you know, if you're on the wrong side, that's going to be the end of the country. I don't think most people, when push comes to shove, would take action on those beliefs. And I think there are ways to depolarize them. Of course, that's not to minimize the concern. You don't need a lot of people to take action, as we saw on January 6th. You know, a relatively small number of people can wreak a lot of havoc and cause a lot of damage. And so not to minimize the concerns about democracy, particularly on a day where I know there's a lot of concern. But I think we have to be careful in terms of how we generalize that across the population.
Okay, so let me ask you if you both want to kind of take us through. Well, you want to describe kind of intervention by intervention? Take through the audience through what you think they need to know about this.
Sure. I'll describe four classes of interventions.
Yeah.
And so what we did as you mentioned, we tested 25 different interventions. And the study more generally is we solicited interventions. And one of the interesting aspects of the study is we solicited these and we received them from a very wide swath of the population. So it wasn't not just academics submitting interventions, but it was also a lot of people who work in civic organizations or bridging organizations that try to depolarize. We also got interventions from students. And so we ended up getting about 250 people submitting interventions. And then from those, we went through a process to select 25 to test. And there are really four classes of interventions that seem to be quite effectual. One was the one that the Utah intervention, which, and I should say that they overlap a little bit, but the Utah one you could think of as elite messaging. And when elites come together and they message a certain perspective, then citizens of their parties, and in that case of both parties, given it was a bipartisan message, they're going to move. You know, they delegate information acquisition to elites, and so when elites from their party come together and send a message, that can have an effect. So that one class of intervention lies with elites, and that then gives us insight into why are we so polarized. We can kind of tie some of that back to elites. Second intervention is just contact. And so one of the really interesting interventions was a commercial from the UK that was a Heineken commercial originally, and it showed people from very differing perspectives. So people who are very concerned about climate change and other people who are very dismissive of climate change, people who are feminists and people who are very traditional in their gender values, meeting each other and having a pretty negative reaction initially. And then they were asked to share a beer. And they all agreed to share a beer. And as they talked through things, they kind of came to agreement and they kind of humanized one another. And so this type of positive contact is another approach. And coming back to the geographic message that you mentioned earlier, that's in part why there's a concern about this geographic isolation. It's because we're not getting that type of contact.
Can I just before I move on? So on the getting together and getting a beer, how are you finding a population? I mean, what was the actual work that put them together?
Yeah, so that's the challenge. And so it was a commercial, so they actually had found these people to put them together. So that raises the challenge of how do we do that? And I think, you know, one of those ways to do that would be in different points of kind of community or civic engagement. And so you might think of organizations like community centers, YMCA, JCC, the League of Women Voters brings people together. So, you know, points of contact or even farmers markets, you know, bring people together and from different where you're not arriving at those events because of your partisan disposition, but rather for some other reason, sporting events. And, you know, if you can get people to kind of share some of their perspectives on society, then that can depolarize somewhat. And so that's a second type of a way of doing that.
Okay. And by the way, Dr. Hecht, I'm not surprised that getting people together in physical proximity can be helpful. But again, the way we're sort of self-sorting, that it takes a scientific experiment to get some people who disagree together sometimes. And many Americans may not do that very often, if ever, anymore. It's almost like we have to be intentional about it. I don't know. How do you see it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's becoming more and more challenging to get people together to have these kinds of conversations. In the case of this intervention, I think what was promising about it and what makes it perhaps a little bit more scalable is it seems like you can even kind of vicariously experience this, right? Because these folks watched other people have these interactions where they had different political views, but got to see the humanity in one another and spend time getting to know each other and become closer. And it seems like, at least in the short term, just viewing people, other people making those kinds of connections, was enough to reduce how hostile people felt toward people of the other political party.
Okay, that's hopeful. I didn't mean to interrupt, Dr. Druckmann, if you want to continue here.
No, not at all. A third type of intervention would be correcting misperceptions of the other side. So we've touched on this a bit. Insofar as people do have these stereotypes of members of the other party as being particularly extreme, likely to obfuscate, likely to engage in violence, likely to engage in anti-democratic behaviors. And so to give you one example, people overestimate the likelihood of somebody from the other party engaging in a violent act by about 400%. And so it's really, we have these kind of really exaggerated perceptions. And so if you can get in there and correct those perceptions, just with informational interventions even, that can be quite effectual as well. And that kind of speaks to the role of media insofar as a lot of people would point to media as a primary source of where these exaggerated misperceptions come from. And then the fourth type of intervention, which I'll turn it over to Cameron to talk a little bit more about, is the creation of a common identity and kind of how do we go, right? A lot of people reference back to, you know, we were in a much more depolarized era during the Cold War, and perhaps part of that was due to the fact that we had a clear external enemy, and so that kind of allowed some common identity of being American. We saw after 9/11 there was some depolarization trends as well. But then you jump forward to COVID, and there was no depolarization trends as well. So how do we create that feeling of common identity? And that's where one of the more effective interventions we tested was the one that Cameron innovated.
Well, I'm very curious about this because, you know, your colleague brings up COVID. I remember in March of 2020 thinking very naively that, well, at the very least, we're going to see a lot of rallying together here. This is it's a different kind of common enemy, but we all have to deal with this and you're going to see a lot of solidarity. And it obviously not only never happened, but polarization increased. So take us through this intervention and what we've learned here.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned COVID. You're right. We completely saw the opposite. And so what my colleagues and I really honed in on in our intervention is the role that the news media and social media have played in perpetuating polarization. So at a broad level, our intervention kind of had two goals. One was, of course, to reduce feelings of animosity toward people with different political beliefs. The other related goal was to try to reduce people's consumption of highly polarizing news and social media content. The reason for that secondary goal was that there's been more and more both academic journal articles and accounts from insiders to the media coming forward recently and basically revealing how profitable stoking outrage has been in the country. So when you kind of have people divided into these two parties of Democrat and Republican, conservative and liberal, and they feel like the other side is a threat to their way of life and a threat to the country, it becomes very highly engaging when you see content about how threatening or how negative that other side is to click on that content to engage with it. And so what we're seeing more and more is that kind of content is getting people to tune in. Which means that it's getting them to consume more ads, which means that it's much more profitable for media companies. So what we have been doing in our intervention is basically providing this information to people. Our intervention came in the form of an expose that provides some of these accounts about how profitable it can be to stoke outrage, to stoke hatred in the media, and how many media companies have jumped onto this strategy. And then basically, I can talk to you kind of about the psychology behind it, but what we do is we encourage people to kind of fight back against this strategy, first of all, by not letting it dictate how they feel about their fellow Americans, right? This strategy works because we feel threatened by and we feel angry toward our fellow Americans. So not letting this strategy work to actually change how we feel about other people. And then second of all, of course, to just kind of protest that content, to be more aware of when is this strategy being used and avoiding engaging with that kind of content. So again, I'm happy to talk more about why we think this worked, but it ended up in this competition reducing animosity by about 10 percentage points.
I want to understand the intervention a little bit better here. It sounds a little bit like it's a form of media literacy.
That's right. Yeah, it is very much like a form of media literacy. It's getting people to be able to recognize when certain tactics are being used in headlines that they're reading or the content that they're encountering on social media that more so than being intended to inform is being intended to inflame, because that can be quite profitable.
Just the language used, the characterizations, that kind of thing. And people are receptive to becoming better educated about the way that they can be manipulated?
Yeah. So we've seen that they're very receptive to it. And I think that there are potentially two main reasons for this. One is, so when people think about the behaviors that they're going to engage in, they attach value to those behaviors, right? We like to do behaviors that we feel good about, that we think other people feel good about, and we avoid behaviors that we feel bad about or think other people feel bad about. Currently, when people consume media content from their preferred news outlet or whatever, what have you, they tend to have multiple reasons to feel positive about it. First of all, they feel like they're being a good citizen. They're staying informed. Second of all, it's kind of like rooting for your sports team. When you get together with your fellow sports fans and denigrate the rival, that feels good. It kind of reinforces that identity. And what this intervention is doing is really undercutting that positive association with consuming news media. Instead, it's replacing it with actually kind of a negative identity, which is when I encounter this content, I'm not staying informed. Actually, I'm kind of being duped by this scam to make me angry, which is harming me and it's harming the people around me to make some other random people money. So we think that's one reason why it's working. The other related kind of psychological piece that we're tapping into is a long-studied construct known as reactance. And this is the idea that when we know that someone is trying to influence or manipulate us, that threatens our sense of independence or autonomy. And so we're motivated to actually kind of do the opposite of what's being suggested.
People don't appreciate being manipulated.
Correct. Yeah. And so we're simply exposing people to this strategy, which is quite manipulative, and the natural reaction is that people want to rebel against that.
This is very heartening to hear, and yet it feels like, again, I'm just going to give you something visceral that is not data at all. When I feel frustrated or nihilistic, it feels like people will justify a lot of different actions and deny that they are being manipulated and say, well, you know, I'm trying not to be partisan or of the moment here. Let's say hypothetically there's a really, really wealthy person who buys a social media platform and changes the rules of the platform and says he wants a neutral platform and then endorses a candidate and then starts using apocalyptic language about other immigrants, even though he himself is not from the country of which he's trying to influence the election. And it would be pretty clear to me that this is a person who's trying to put his thumb on the scales. But people who are sort of on that team already would be like, well, that guy's awesome. Like, what are you talking about? Like, he's not manipulating me. We're on the same side here. So do you encounter that where people resist this idea that they're being manipulated by elites?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. So honestly, so much of this comes into how carefully we write the intervention. When me and my team, so my primary collaborators on this were Dr. Chris Bryan, Dr. David Yeager at the University of Texas at Austin. When we develop these interventions, we're thinking constantly about how could people respond negatively to this intervention, or how might it backfire or not do what we want it to do. And so we developed this intervention by constantly seeking feedback and doing focus groups with people, figuring out what are the ways to frame the arguments where it's going to feel like, yeah, maybe there is this kind of manipulation happening and I want to be on the right side of it, versus they're going to feel threatened and say, no, I'm not being manipulated. So we developed the intervention really carefully with a lot of attention to detail. And what I can really speak to is the data, which is we weren't able to test it as part of this competition because they collected just kind of the same measures so that they could compare every intervention to one another. We're now conducting our own follow-up experiments with this intervention. And what we're finding is to degrees larger than we even thought, the intervention is proving to be really effective at getting people to reconsider where they get their news from. Even the people who are among the most extremely identified with either the right or the left.
That blows me away. Is that what you expected to find?
It's what we tried really, really hard to accomplish. I don't know if I expected the effects to be as large as they actually have been. But to give you some context, I would estimate we invested 200 to 300 hours of just scrutinizing over the language and figuring out how to get the argument just right so that it would have a chance of having this kind of effect.
Dr. Dreckman, what do you make of this particular result?
Yeah, I think it's very promising as well. And it's sensible insofar as, you know, I think when people hear partisan news from one side or the other, it's very easy to kind of view it as, again, cheering for their team, and I'm going to take that in. But we also have to remember that there is, you know, bipartisan suspicion of media writ large. And, you know, there's been one of the few bipartisan areas in governance over the last several years has been discussions about regulation of social media, for example. And in fact, in Utah, that was one of the main thing that the state of Utah has gone forward with. And so, you know, I think to the extent that you can get people to think about the not necessarily the partisan side that the media is coming from, but kind of what is the intent and what is the end goal of the media. And the end goal of the media is really not to inform or to provide any kind of civic positive outlet, but rather to make money. And right there's a profit motivation there. And I think that makes people very leery about media. So I think what you're seeing now, perhaps in the election, is that people are not being exposed to the type of information that Cameron's intervention is providing. So I think the question is how do you kind of get that kind of literacy information kind of spread around, and how do you educate people to think about the media in that sense?
For listeners who are just joining us, the purpose of this particular piece of research was not just to get people to change where they get their news from. It was to find out if they would be receptive of that idea as a means of lowering political polarization. And that's part of what was studied in really a remarkable study, 25 different interventions studied. 23 were found to have some positive effect on lowering political polarization, or, as we'll talk coming up here, perhaps lowering some of the conditions for political violence. And that matters. That certainly matters right now. You're hearing Dr. James Dreckman, a lead researcher on the study and a political scientist with the University of Rochester, Dr. Cameron Hecht, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Rochester. We're going to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back, and we're going to work through some more of not only these the interventions and what they've learned, but listeners, on a day that feels very polarized, can't blame you if you feel really sort of a lot of despair about political polarization. I'd love to hear from you about what works maybe in your sphere, family, neighborhood, whatever. You can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the day after Election Day. We'll talk to winners in some local races. We'll talk to party leaders. We'll take a look at what is going on the national scene. And we'll work through all of the results with you together, talking to many of the people involved at different levels of government. Talk with you Wednesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mark writes to say that the Utah governor ad reminded him of John McCain's comments in the 2008 election. Mark, I think I know what you're talking about. And I'm assuming, Mark, you're talking about it was a town hall. This was not an ad. John McCain was hosting a town hall in 2008, and Vox tells me this happened in Minnesota. And a woman during the town hall said, and here's the quote. She said, "I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's not, he's an Arab." Now, I understand why listeners would want John McCain to say, hey, there's nothing wrong with being an Arab either. And maybe that part of the response that lacked bothered you. But I think John McCain interpreted that remark to basically say, I don't trust him. He is not an American. He's an outside agent. He grabbed the microphone from her and he cut her off. He said, "No, ma'am. He's a decent family man and a citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. But he's not." And that's it. He cut it off. He cut it off right there. I can't imagine that happening in this campaign. McCain was Republican, from Donald Trump doing that. It's hard to imagine Kamala Harris saying that about Donald Trump. And Mark writes in to say he hears echoes of that. I think that will be remembered for the decency of John McCain That'll be part of his legacy, I think, because the reason that moment resonates is even when things feel so tense, Americans don't want that in their leadership by and large. Maybe some do, but I don't think people want that. I think people saw that moment as a moment of humanity when he could have stoked it. Dr. Druckmann, am I overreading that?
No, I think that's right. I think we saw similar things in the 2012 campaign with Mitt Romney. You know, in both those cases, you had opportunities where they could have racialized the campaign. And I think both candidates were very deliberate in deciding not to do that, yeah. Which is obviously in the subsequent campaigns with Donald Trump, that was a primary strategy. And in fact, Donald Trump was trying to prompt racialization of Obama with a birth certificate rumors even during those campaigns. And so, I it was obviously a very different political time back in those campaigns.
MJ writes to say, on class warfare, some of this polarization is a result of poor and uneducated Americans versus the opposite, more emphasis on uneducated. I've seen several older people who may have made a lifetime of poor choices with poor outcomes and seem to want to place blame on the government or illegal immigrants, etc. How can this mindset come to the table with the defensiveness being so pervasive for personal self-preservation? And it's now reinforced by social media memes. That is from MJ. Dr. Hecht, what would you say to MJ?
Yeah, So first of all, I don't think you can understate the importance of education. In fact, what we're talking about today is part of the research I do. Actually, the majority of the research I do is in education, so it's an incredibly large value to me. I'm reluctant to attribute the way that people vote and their political beliefs purely to education or to implications about their intelligence. I think a lot of people experiencing different socioeconomic realities have different there are different political arguments that are resonating with them. So I think a lot of folks in certain communities feel underserved by the present administration, or there's often a feeling of threat that because the country is becoming there are more immigrants coming in because it's becoming less of a white country. They're worried, with like DEI efforts and stuff, they're concerned that they're going to be left behind, and that even though, maybe they're from a lower social class background, their specific needs are going to be ignored at the expense of others who have experienced marginalization, maybe on the base of race or something. So I think there's a wide variety of reasons why people support the candidates that they support. And while I might not agree with them, I'd be reluctant to attribute it too heavily just to education.
Okay. Dr. Druckmann?
Yeah, I was just going to add, I think that it's a great question, and I agree with everything Cameron just said. I think, stepping back, we live in an extremely unstable time. I mean, it's been a very unstable it's been a very unstable century. I mean, we had a great recession. We've had massive demographic change. We've had massive media technological change, and so it's understandable that people feel a bit of a loss of control over kind of where they are, where they stand. We have kind of the first generation of people who are likely to not do as well as their parents, and so we have massive economic inequality. And so the question is, when people are feeling that lack of control, where are they going to attribute the causes of that lack of control, and where are they going to look to solve the lack of control they're feeling? And I think that's where political messaging becomes very important. And you can either try to message that, you should blame the other side, and then that leads into this kind of existential argument between the parties that should be, at some level, coordinating on the fundamental values of the country. Or you can try to think about the larger way to kind of advance society. And I think that's where some of what Cameron's intervention is along those lines, trying to kind of move the attribution of responsibility away from the political system writ large and try to move it to actors that may have some role.
Some criticism from a listener for the host and for the study. Dal says, I think you're enjoying this, Evan, because you're listening to you're hearing things that reinforce your own ideas. First of all, I am very much susceptible to that. We all have biases. I definitely have biases. One of my biases is that I think that we are doing ourselves a disservice when we never, ever spend any time with people who think differently. I think the ideological self-sorting is very damaging, and I think it gains velocity over time, and I think we're seeing some of the effects. So I think the interventions that they're talking about definitely go to my priors. It makes me feel like there's hope. It makes me feel like if we truly get spend more time together, have a beer together, understand each other better, correct misperceptions about one another, that the hatred or the anger will get tamped down. And I think it's valuable to pursue that. He says, do you think Elon is manipulating the people who agree with him? Not necessarily. I think he's trying to manipulate some people at times. I mean, he told Joe Rogan he thinks that if Donald Trump loses, it could be the last American election ever. And just think about that, man. Like, Elon Musk is supporting Donald Trump, the only guy who ever in this country who did not agree to a peaceful transition of power from the presidency and who tried to cheat and almost got away with it. And he is saying that, no, despite all of that, it is the Democrats, if they win, they'll never let people vote again. I mean, that's bizarro world projection to me, and I think that is manipulation. And then he says the interventions they're talking about remind me of Hillary Clinton saying we need re-education camps for conservatives. I don't know if Hillary Clinton said exactly that. I don't know if she said it flippantly. She said a lot of things that were quite derisive about people who didn't vote for her. I would think and I hope she regrets some of what she said. So I'm not saying she didn't say that, Dallas, but I don't think at all that the interventions my guests are talking about amounts to re-education camps for conservatives. Dr. Druckmann?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, and I appreciate your engagement with it. You know, we tried very hard to evaluate interventions in a nonpartisan fashion, and when we did look at the effects of these interventions, they didn't really have a differential effect amongst Republicans or Democrats, and we really also were not none of these interventions were such that we were trying to change people's fundamental values or their beliefs per se. It was more so they would learn more about the other side, learn more about the value of democracy, or learn more about what might be the cause of the situation of polarization that the country finds itself in. So I can understand why it might come across that way. In fact, that kind of aligns with a little bit of Cameron's intervention, right? If it sounds like these interventions are manipulating people, people don't like the interventions. And so you do have to be careful when you're doing interventional research that they are done in a kind of a as fair a way possible.
But this was not, Dallas, designed to get your dad off Fox News.
No.
That's not what this was about. It wasn't picking one particular ideological media sphere and trying to get people off that. Right, Dr. Hecht?
That's right. Yeah. Speaking, the question sounds maybe specifically about the intervention that I was talking about. So the goal was not to target one specific side and try to change how they would engage with the news or with social media. It was really intended to be bipartisan and to basically increase the, I like how you put it, basically increase media literacy on both sides. And in fact, what we've seen is equal effects across both sides in terms of intentions to change consumption behaviors.
Let me get a phone call. This is Celeste in Rochester first on the line. Hello, Celeste. Go ahead.
Hi. You had asked a question, call in, how do you deal with people or friends or family? Well, you know, when you have such polarized opinions or set of facts even, right? And so, boy, have my husband and I struggled so hard because one goes back 38 years that I've known and loved and was there for the birth of my babies. And, you know, some things have changed for them and their experiences have. And so now they're listening to different kinds of media than I would, or I do. And so sometimes we hear things that we say, well, you know, they will never hear this. They'll never know this because they don't listen to this. And my other friend who I'm very, these are very intelligent people. I have the utmost respect for them. And so we think we should be talking, and sometimes we have maybe me and the different women have. I try to hear what they're trying where are they coming from? But what we've come to is that we get together a lot, and when we do, we enjoy each other's companies. We know that we have very. Our values are common. There are common values. Mm-hmm. And we celebrate each other for the people that we are, the human beings. And therefore, we have not taught. I think this intervention stuff is fantastic because it would open my... I am confused about how can they draw their conclusions, but hey, they did. They're smart, and they're respected and very, very loved. And they love me and my family and other people, and they're caring and giving and wonderful human beings. So that's all there is to that. That's what I wanted to say.
Thank you, Celeste. I appreciate that phone call. Let me ask our guests if they want to respond. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great story. I mean, that's in some sense what we would be striving for, to have people have more relationships like that. And I also think it raises two important points. One is, you know, I think if people have relationships with people who are having contrasting political perspectives, you know, it's not incumbent upon you to necessarily always talk about politics or ever talk about politics. I mean, you can certainly have social relationships where you exclude politics from that space. To the extent that you do, I think the key thing is that you engage in active listening. That is, you don't try to tell people why they're wrong or what the actual truth is per se, but rather you engage them, have them have some sense of efficacy so you understand where they're coming from, they can understand where you're coming from, and try to isolate where points of disagreement are. I think that sounds like what you're engaging in.
Celeste, thank you very much. By the way, Dallas wanted to know about colleges being monolithically ideological. He said, do colleges need interventions? If professors and college employees are around 85% Democrat, maybe they need one. What do you think, Guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously, higher education has become an extremely politicized domain. You know, trust in higher education is polarized along partisan lines. And I do think that colleges are taking that question up quite seriously in terms of what are ways that they can go about engaging in hearing from different sides of an issue. And I think hopefully we'll see more of that. So I agree with that.
Let me ask our guests who are joining us with the University of Rochester, talking about this study. 25 different interventions studied, 23 different interventions yielded some positive results as we look for ways to bring down political polarization. Dr. Druckmann, I'll start with you. What about the concern about political violence? People are worried about that. Understandably so. And we're looking for interventions that actually bring down the conditions for violence. What did we find?
Yeah. So there's a few good points of good news here. One is that the support for political, you know, we were studying support for political violence. We're not able to study actually engaging in political violence for obvious reasons. And the good news is that the levels of support for political violence are low. Most people do not support political violence. The second point of good news is that there are ways to reduce the extent to which people support political violence. And, you know, two ways to go about doing that is one is when people support violence against another group, it's often because they dehumanize the other group. They think of the other group as less than human. And that's a fairly well understood dynamic when it comes to any type of violence. And so to the extent that you can humanize the other side through any of these interventions that reduce animosity or kind of correct perceptions of the other side as being extreme, that's a way to reduce support for violence. Another way is, as I mentioned earlier, that people vastly exaggerate the extent to which they think the other side supports political violence. And so often when people are supporting political violence, they're doing it in a defensive posture, which I mean that they're doing it because they're anticipating the other side to engage in violence. So they think, well, we probably should engage in violence as well. So once they can get that kind of the reality that the other side, actually, most people do not want to engage in political violence, and kind of learning of those realities, then you become less likely to think that there's a need to engage in support for defensive political violence.
Thank goodness. Anything you want to add there, Cameron?
No, I guess just that I think the same dynamic also kind of applies to people's support for candidates who might even support undemocratic practices. Kinds of practices, these kinds of behaviors that I think on face value we all agree should not be engaged in. When we perceive that the other side is engaging in these things and maybe gaining some sort of unfair advantage, and we're afraid of losing power because of it, it makes us more likely to support candidates who would support those kinds of practices on our own side. So I think that dynamic plays not only for political violence, but also for undemocratic behaviors.
Amy writes to say, very interesting show. I seem to be in a minority in my circle of friends and that I have friends who are part of another political party. They are very nice people. And I am dating someone who holds opposite views of my political beliefs, yet we still get along fairly well. I ascribe to the idea that we are more the same than we are different. Curiously, I get a lot of pushback, mainly from my liberal friends. I lean left of center myself. They're concerned about who I am dating and how could I possibly be involved or even talk to someone like him. Amy, thank you for the note. There's all kinds of data in terms of surveys about what's changed over time. Would you want your child to date someone from a different political party? Would you date someone from a different political party? And that has changed. That has really, really moved in rough directions. And Amy's saying she's hearing it even more from the left than she is from the right. Cameron, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think these, like you said, these patterns have been playing out for some time, where people themselves are more reluctant to date or become friends with people from the opposite political party, where people don't want their children to. I'm happy and I'm heartened to hear that you are pursuing that relationship and that you do maintain friendships with people from the other side. I think it becomes more and more difficult the more there's social pressure, not to be kind of a bad team member, so to speak, by fraternizing with the enemy, if you kind of put it in those terms. And so I'm glad that you've been able to maintain those relationships. And, I think it's consistent with what Jamie was saying of maintaining those relationships. I think really involves, at least for surface level relationships, maybe you just don't make your relationship as much about politics. Maybe you focus more on other things that connect you. But if you are going to have a more serious and romantic relationship with someone who holds different political beliefs, I think you really do have to listen very carefully and try to understand their perspective rather than just purely divide yourself on along ideological lines.
Let me get in the Finger Lakes. Listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio. This is Tim. Hello, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Very good.
I just was calling in quick to make a kind of a comment how you were asking how the division in the politics affects people's lives. My wife's been waiting for a kidney transplant for almost 6 years for the third time. And we live in a very rural area where it's very conservative and we tend to not lean that way. And we have gotten no interest in helping out with our plea for a kidney or a donor. And I just wanted to put how the divisiveness in our society today has gotten so ratcheted up that it actually is affecting people's lives, life and death.
Tim, can I just ask a brief question, Tim?
Absolutely.
And let me ask this with all sensitivity, because I'm not there living your life, and I'm sorry that you're feeling like that political division is affecting you. Are you certain that it's political? I mean, the goal of getting a kidney donation is a big one. That's a huge commitment. And are you sure that that's political division that you're seeing?
When you get lack to the degree that we have of interest in helping someone out, and what I didn't get to say at the end, I would love to see people just get to know their neighbor. And that's where what I heard you say in this show today is that how just getting to know people and sitting down and having a beer together
indeed
would be an amazing thing, just to get to know the other side and who lives around them and what their needs are and what their interests and how people vote, why it affects so much in people's lives.
Well, Tim, I appreciate you sharing that. First of all the love and good luck to you and your family. I hope that you only have improved and healing relationships with those around you. And I know that can be difficult. And in that spirit, down to our last couple of minutes, thank you, Tim. Maybe I'll ask our guests, what interventions didn't we get to? And we'll publish the results online so listeners can see them. But what else stands out to you? What's working, Dr. Druckmann?
Yeah, I mean, I think we touched on the ones that had the largest
potential.
Yeah, the largest potential. There were a lot of interventions that were kind of a similar class. And so there were a large number that were looking at misperceptions of the other side. And I think a lot of the conversations and a lot of the calls that came in were really talking about, let's get to know one another a little bit more.
Clear up misperceptions.
Yeah.
And that just supports the data that comes from this. Anything that you want to add about what we haven't talked about, Dr. Hecht?
No, I agree with Jamie. I think we really touched on kind of the biggest classes of interventions that had the biggest effects.
Well, We will share as much as we can in our show notes when we post the audio for this program, wherever you get your podcasts, connections, WXXINews.org/connections. And I'll just, you know, close with this. I hope, I've been reading your emails, even if I didn't get to them on the air. And I hope that wherever you are, whatever happens today, you find a way to have that beer or to have that conversation with a neighbor, with a family member, with someone around you. The more that we silo, the more dangerous it is. And that's part of what the study has shown. But the study also shows us, these interventions show us, that there is a route away from that. There is a route to diffusing that. And we don't have to do this like this. We don't have to live like that. And that should be hopeful no matter the results tonight, no matter what happens. And so if you want to join us tonight, coverage starts on WXXI. I'll be here at 8 p.m. going until whenever. Who knows? Who knows if we'll have full results in the presidential election? I don't know. But I hope wherever you are, you feel some peace and comfort and love. And I want to thank Dr. James Druckmann and Dr. Cameron Hecht from the University of Rochester for sharing what they found in this survey. Thank you for doing the work and for reminding us that things can change. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We'll talk to you tonight, listeners. And if not, from the whole team, David, Evan, Megan, Rob, we are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.